Today is Tuesday, December 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The clock is ticking as Britain and the European Union try to avoid a no-deal Brexit.
Conditions had still not been met to finalize any type of post-Brexit trade agreement.
Plus, dispelling fears of the COVID-19 vaccine.
What we've also seen is that the online space provides a really fertile environment for different conspiracy theories that already existed.
And remembering a music legend. We'll have these stories and more next. British and European Union leaders failed to narrow differences over an elusive post-Brexit trade deal in last-ditch telephone diplomacy efforts on Monday, leaving themselves just 48 hours to avoid a disorderly parting of the ways at the end of the month. In a joint statement released by the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the leaders say, quote, the conditions for an agreement are not there due to remaining differences on critical issues, end quote. And to find out what's going to happen next, I spoke with reporter Catherine Field in Paris via WhatsApp.
As you say, there was that long phone call between the two of them, more than an hour. They were talking and going over what has been discussed by chief negotiators since last Friday. At the end of it, they both came out, issued a statement saying that conditions had still not been met to finalize any type of post-Brexit trade agreement. So what they've decided to do is to get their chief negotiators back to the negotiating table on Tuesday. They will then put together a list of the outstanding differences, those three key areas where they can't agree, and to put those on a piece of paper, hand it back to their bosses, and then later in the week, the EU Commission President von der Leyen and Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, will sit down together in person in Brussels and try and find a way out of this.
Speaking of trying to get a way out of this, Catherine, you're in Paris and the vote for Brexit took place in 2016. What's the mood throughout Europe? Because discussions about Britain leaving the European Union have been going on for 4 years.
There seems to be pretty much agreement that there will not be this great overarching free trade agreement that UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said was oven ready, was ready to be signed. There is absolute agreement that that is not going to happen. Whether or not there will be some sort of very small, much more discreet agreement to sort of keep talking is a possibility. But you're quite right to mention, you know, what does Europe think of this? Well, if you talk to some of the EU member states, particularly in the East, Poland, the Baltic states, Romania, Greece, they've really moved on. They've got their own issues to worry about, such as COVID, the economic downturn. That's what they're really concerned about. If you talk to, say, the coastal countries, particularly France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Denmark, they're just worried about fisheries. They say fisheries is what concerns them most because that's where, you know, one of the areas that the UK is playing hardball on. They essentially, the UK is saying, unless you're a UK boat, a UK fishing company, you will need to come to us to get agreement to come and fish in our waters. If you talk to Germany, Italy, or France, they are really worried about the business competition, you know, this whole level playing field, because they're the big industrialized countries in Europe. They are really going to suffer if the UK backpedals and undercuts those sweetheart deals with British manufacturers, so as they're undercutting Europeans on the market. So it really does pretty much depend on who you talk to. Again, you talk to the Spanish and they're worried about tourism from the UK. So it really is different. EU countries have different ideas on where this is going, but very few of them actually are talking about it as much, say, as the UK government or Ireland, which really does stand to lose a lot of their economic power if there is no deal.
Speaking of Ireland, that has been an area of concern for a lot of people because of the Good Friday Accords. So what is the latest on discussions to try and prevent a hard border between Ireland and Northern Ireland?
There still is no agreement. There really is still no agreement. It was hoped that there would be no border down the Irish Sea. Then it was hoped that there would be frictionless trade between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. All we have at the moment is, for example, Dublin, the Irish Republic. They are saying, we're going to stand by the Good Friday Agreement. We've also got the incoming American administration, President-elect Joe Biden, saying, we're watching that Good Friday Agreement. We do not want another border along the island of Ireland. So there is no agreement there either. Again, we're just waiting. We've got, what, just less than 3 weeks before the end of the transition period when the UK finally cuts loose from the European Union.
Catherine Field reports from Paris, France. The World Health Organization says it does not foresee mandatory vaccinations being introduced around the world to stem the spread of the coronavirus. But the WHO's Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, urged countries to prioritize those who are most vulnerable.
Based on the values framework and population prioritization roadmap issued by WHO's Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization, this document provide recommendations on who should be considered for vaccination first and lays out the values that inform those recommendations. These are not easy decisions. Vaccinating health workers who are at high risk of infection will help to protect them and the health system. People at highest risk of serious disease or death as a result of age are also a high priority group because protecting them will reduce severe disease and death and take the burden off health systems.
WHO Director of Immunization Vaccines and Biologicals, Kate O'Brien, says there may be some countries or some situations in countries where there are professional circumstances where it would be required to be vaccinated or where it would be highly recommended to do so. In addition, as the world enters the holiday season, Mike Ryan, the head of the WHO Emergencies Program, says it will be months before it may be safe to hug one another again.
And maybe because we're here talking today about hugs and about how much we would like those hugs over the holiday period and just how getting that close to people in a situation with intense community transmission can be so tragically dangerous. And that's, I think, the awful, brutal dilemma that we all face. It's a horrible thing to think that we would be here as the World Health Organization saying to people, don't hug each other.
There are new restrictions in the western U.S. state of California due to COVID-19. And AP correspondent Rita Foley has that story.
California's new restrictions cover many parts of the state, ordering residents to stay home and closing businesses. Bobby Javanek in North Hollywood headed for the grocery store, telling KABC.
You got to do what you got to do because, I mean, look what happened last time. This store had plenty of toilet paper, so I don't have to worry about that. But who knows what we're going to have next week.
But across the country in New York City, it's back to school again for some children, preschool students and children in kindergarten through fifth grade. School Chancellor Richard Carranza says we've proven we can do it safely. And parents want that for their children. I'm Rita Foley.
Currently, there are about 67.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 globally, according to statistics tabulated by Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. And about 15 million of those are in the U.S. alone. The coronavirus has also killed more than 1.5 million people, and about 43.3 million have recovered from COVID-19. Germany expects to commence a coronavirus vaccine rollout early in January, and AP's Charles de Ledesma has more.
Chancellor Angela Merkel's chief of staff says he expects coronavirus shots to start in the very first days of the new year. The trained doctor says he's prepared to help vaccinate people himself. EU authorities are expected to make a decision by December 29 on approving the first vaccine for use. Meanwhile, Germany is getting special vaccination centres ready. Infection figures in Germany have more or less stabilised at a high level since a partial shutdown started on November 2, but haven't decreased. Experts say tighter restrictions are needed, at least in the hotspots. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A U.S. federal panel of vaccine experts is meeting this week to consider Pfizer's vaccine and again next week for Moderna's. AP correspondent Shelley Adler has those details.
Once the green light is hopefully given, the country's largest ever vaccination effort will start. Federal officials estimate 20 million people in the first priority group could be vaccinated by the end of the year. But the big question for infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci, when will everyone get the protection?
I would think by the time you get to the beginning of April, you'll start getting people who have no high priority.
Pharmacies, health clinics, and your doctor's office are the likely options to get the shot. Local health departments will also most likely run mass vaccination clinics. I'm Shelley Adler.
A sizable minority of people believe conspiracy theories about the coronavirus and COVID-19 vaccines. Some experts have warned, just as countries prepare to launch mass inoculations to get the pandemic under control. Reuters' Emily Wither has that part of our story.
Many here don't believe in COVID-19 or think their lives should change because of it. And many of them refuse to be vaccinated against it. Experts are warning that a sizable minority of people in Britain believe conspiracy theories about the coronavirus and COVID-19 vaccines. They say they're shocked at how fast this kind of misinformation can spread and how easily it's taken as fact. Daniel Freeman is a psychology professor at Oxford University.
What we're finding is in the wake of the pandemic that conspiracy beliefs may have gone mainstream, that they're no longer confined to the fringes. So around half the population isn't thinking in terms of conspiracy beliefs at all, but around a quarter are entertaining such thoughts. Another quarter are consistently thinking in terms of conspiracy beliefs. Around one in 10 people seem to have a very high rate of endorsement of conspiracy beliefs.
Just as countries prepare to launch mass vaccination programs, they'll also need to convince some of the population to take part. Leela Hay is a student in the northern English city of Hull. She says it's easy to get sucked into believing what you read about vaccines and the pandemic, even though she now says it has no basis in truth.
I was looking at like a lot of groups and they were just there like for anyone to go into. They were very public and had a lot of followers, and so you were looking, so there was like thousands of people who were sharing like so much information, and so it was literally like all day you could just go on them and you were constantly discovering something new and constantly coming across something different.
Logging online, the internet is full of rumors and false information. Views like the pandemic was fabricated by governments to control people, or the Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates wanted to use vaccines to insert trackable microchips into people. Tom Phillips, editor at fact-checking charity Full Fact, says rumors and false information during pandemics have been around for centuries, but some of the theories Leela once believed came via QAnon, a platform that has become a big tent conspiracy theory, encompassing misinformation about topics ranging from alien landings to vaccine safety.
What we've also seen is that the online space provides a really fertile environment for different conspiracy theories that already existed to merge and kind of center around the pandemic. So we've seen pre-existing anti-vaccination beliefs, we've seen pre-existing concerns around 5G technology, we've been seen pre-existing conspiracy theories about New World Order type conspiracies. These have all kind of merged and they've been brought together because they're suddenly all talking about one news event, and the online space gives them the opportunity to cross over between each other.
The fight to find a vaccine may have been won, but there's another conflict brewing as governments now need to convince their populations about the best way to protect themselves.
Emily Wither reports for Reuters News. And still to come,
our life together is so precious. Together we have grown.
We have grown. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Despite ongoing construction of the U.S. National Science Foundation's Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope, scientists have released its first image of a sunspot. Thomas Rimele, associate director at the National Solar Observatory, which is responsible for building and operating the new telescope, says the captured sunspot image offers a spatial resolution that's about 2.5 times higher than what had been captured before. The solar telescope is part of the Haleakala Observatory and is located on the Hawaiian island of Maui. Telescope officials say that their sunspot image illustrates how the telescope's 4-meter primary mirror and the advanced optics will provide scientists with the best view from Earth to observe the sun throughout the next solar cycle. Construction of the telescope is expected to be completed in July 2021. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has traveled to Paris to boost economic and military ties. Nicholas Pinot reports the dealings present a dilemma for the French government in light of Egypt's poor human rights record.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi arrived in Paris at the start of the week. The French president's office said topping the agenda in el-Sisi's meeting with President Emmanuel Macron was Libya and Syria. To counter Turkey's push to expand its influence in the region, France and Egypt stress the need for Eastern Mediterranean to remain as a space for cooperation which respects all sovereignties, the French presidency said in a statement. In January 2019, el-Sisi and Macron met in Cairo, where the French president said that Egypt was not headed in the right direction on human rights. Ahead of Monday's meeting, several NGOs issued a statement pressing on President Emmanuel Macron to take a strong stand on the issue. Their statement said that France had, in the group's words, long indulged President el-Sisi's brutal repression of any form of dissent.
Depuis l'arrivée au pouvoir du président Sisi, une répression sans précédent s'abat.
Katia Roux, in charge of advocacy with Amnesty International France, says there has been an unprecedented repression against civil society in Egypt since el-Sisi became president in 2014. Roux says the international community is not doing enough to ensure Egypt respects human rights. In a joint press conference at a French presidential palace, Macron rebuked the critics and vowed to continue the sale of weapons to Egypt.
Je ne conditionnerai pas notre coopération en matière de défense comme en matière économique.
The French president said he opposes any condition on matters of defense and economic cooperation because of what he describes as disagreements over human rights. Macron says it is more effective to have a policy of demanding dialogue than a boycott, which, he says, would only reduce the effectiveness of a partner in the fight against terrorism and for the region's stability. Egypt has become a strategic partner for France in the Middle East amid growing tensions with Turkey. The Egyptian government is a major weapons client for French fighter jets and warships. However, no major contracts were expected to be signed during this visit. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
The Trump administration has approved a new major arms sales to Taiwan and is placing sanctions on Chinese officials over the crackdown on pro-democracy advocates in Hong Kong. The moves announced Monday are sure to draw a firm rebuke from China, which regards Taiwan as a renegade province and has rejected Hong Kong-related measures as interference in internal affairs. The State Department said it had approved a $280 million sale to Taiwan of advanced military communications equipment. Earlier, it said it hit 14 members of the Chinese Parliament's Standing Committee with sanctions that come as the administration steps up punitive measures against China as it winds down its time in office. The United States said Monday that the legislative elections held in Venezuela Sunday, in which President Nicolas Maduro's Socialist Political Alliance is set to gain control of the National Assembly, were a sham. National Assembly is the last of the country's branches of government where the U.S.-backed opposition held sway. The United States is one of 50 countries that does not recognize Maduro as Venezuela's leader, instead supporting National Assembly President Juan Guaido, who claimed victory in the January 2019 presidential elections, but has not assumed office. The European Union also refused to send independent election monitors Sunday, claiming the conditions for a democratic process did not exist. Ghanaians voted on Monday in what is expected to be a close race between President Nana Akufo-Addo and his main rival John Mahama, who are offering competing plans to end an economic crisis. If re-elected for a second four-year term, Akufo-Addo has promised to push ahead with a $17 billion recovery program to boost jobs. Mahama's keystone pledge is a $10 billion infrastructure plan. 40 years ago, former Beatle John Lennon was killed outside his apartment in New York City. His violent death shook the world. He was 40 years old. Yet 4 decades later, the man and his music still matter to Lennon's own generation and to their children and their children's children. In this report, native New Yorker Adam Phillips pays tribute to John Lennon, his music, and the man.
Strawberry Fields is a peaceful spot in Central Park dedicated to John Lennon's memory, a mere 50 or so meters from the Upper West Side apartment building where he lived and died. The usual gaggle of tourists and fans are sitting on benches, some in contemplation, others in song. What is this place all about, Strawberry Fields?
It needs peace, it needs music, serenity. It feels like my home.
Is there something about John Lennon that sort of pervades the place?
I feel closer to him when I'm here.
Decades ago, a deranged fan was able to get close enough to the musician to shoot him. The murder shocked the city and the world. Rock and roll photographer Bob Gruen, who knew John Lennon well as a friend, says the pain from that shock can last a lifetime.
You get a deep wound. Eventually, the wound, you know, heals, but you still have a scar. You know, he didn't really say things that people didn't know. In fact, what he said was what everybody does know, but he just had a magical way of expressing things.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not more better.
John Lennon wrote the melancholy song In My Life during the Beatles' earlier days. Its tone is in sharp contrast with the saccharine lyrics that were typical for boy groups at the time. Reporter Larry Kane, the author of Lennon Revealed, got to know the Beatle during the band's American tours.
John Lennon was a man who was very embittered and angry most of his life. He was born to a father who was never around, a mother who disappeared mostly. He had a best friend who died of a brain hemorrhage at the age of 20. But he was also, on the flip side of that, one of the most extraordinary people I'd ever met in terms of his ability to overcome those demons that lurked inside of him and produce a beautiful music, beautiful poetry, and beautiful writing.
This room at the top, they are telling you still.
But Lennon also produced highly political music and poetry.
But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill.
Newsweek editor Jeff Giles has written extensively about the lead singer.
I think he was kind of a brave person. He took political stands very early, took on issues right out of the day's newspapers. He wanted the music to matter. To be that famous and to still risk everything for stuff you believe in means a lot to people.
Lennon often used his fame to make a point in theatrical ways. This is Give Peace a Chance, which he and Yoko Ono recorded in the early 1970s in a Montreal hotel room with their friends during the couple's week-long bed-in for peace. A watershed moment for Lennon came in 1971 when he left his native England and settled in New York City with his wife, Yoko Ono.
New York City.
Photographer Bob Gruen says Lennon saw the Big Apple as the world's artistic and cultural center and felt he could be almost anonymous here.
You know, in England, people would chase him down the street and get hysterical when they saw him. But in New York, people see famous people a lot, but you're kind of busy, and everybody's got somewhere to go. So he could go to the corner, buy a newspaper, go into the espresso shop, have coffee and read the paper, and people wouldn't bother him so much. So he could take taxis around. I mean, he was like a normal person here.
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown.
In 1975, when he was 35 years old, Lennon stopped writing and recording music and for 5 years settled into life as a house husband and dedicated father to the couple's young child, Sean. Yoko handled his multi-million dollar music business. This reversal of gender roles was in itself unusual for that era. In 1980, the couple recorded and released a new album called Double Fantasy. Its hit single, Starting Over, proved to be John Lennon's last. This is Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Why can't we make it look nice and easy? It's time to spread our wings and fly. Don't let another day go by, my love. It'll be just like starting
listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a terrific Tuesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's recent trip to the Mideast, two themes emerged. The first was confidence that more nations in the region would join Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan in the Abraham Accords and normalize their relations with Israel. The second was that the region was unified in recognizing the threat posed by an aggressive Iranian regime. Speaking in Jerusalem before a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Bahraini Foreign Minister Abdullatif bin Rashid Al Zayani, Secretary Pompeo said, "These agreements are important for so many reasons, important for the whole world. These agreements open up wonderful opportunities for commerce and economic development. These agreements also tell malign actors like the Islamic Republic of Iran that their influence in the region is waning and that they are ever more isolated, and this shall forever be unless Iran's leaders change their direction." In an interview in Abu Dhabi with Al Arabiya Television, Secretary Pompeo said that more nations in the region will make the choice on their own timing to join the Abraham Accords because it's the right thing to do for their nation, because it'll increase prosperity and security for their country. He noted that previously it was believed that peace could be achieved only if the problems between Israel and Palestinians could be solved in their entirety. That was fundamentally wrong, he said. It didn't recognize the reality. The reality is that now the Gulf states and Israel recognize they have a common threat from Iran. In an interview in Abu Dhabi with National Review magazine, Secretary Pompeo emphasized the importance of resolving the Israel-Palestinian conflict. But, he said, we can't stand by as we have for 40 years and allow that conflict to be the precondition for further enhancement of peace and stability. Secretary Pompeo called the Abraham Accords a marker for the future of the Middle East. It took American engagement and American leadership, said Secretary Pompeo. And when we do that, when America is a force for good throughout the world, including in the Middle East, Other nations will want to come alongside of us, and they'll make the right choices, including the choice to partner with Israel for their prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.